This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. Why do so many white people have no black friends? And is racial integration and equal opportunity for all even possible? These are some questions posed by author Tanner Colby in his book, Some of My Best Friends Are Black. For answers, Colby visited Kansas City in 2009, among other cities. What he discovered was a history of discriminatory practices in real estate. J.C. Nichols once enjoyed the dubious distinction of being a national leader in developing and maintaining all-white communities. Susan caught up with Tanner Colby to learn more about how neighborhoods impact relationships and opportunity.
If we've had 40 years of affirmative action and school busing and fair housing and all these different policies, and yet in 2008 I still don't know any black people, then my life would have to be a pretty typical example of what went wrong. And so I went back to look at all the various places in my life, the school that I went to, the neighborhoods I lived in, the places where I'd worked. And not only were they all almost all lily white, they were all pretty textbook examples of the failures of integration. One was my high school in Birmingham, Alabama, which was your typical white flight suburb, much like, you know, Overland Park and a lot of the Kansas Johnson County suburbs, only with the added benefit of our school mascot being the Confederate rebel and our school flag being the Confederate flag. So it was pretty extreme in that way.
So part of this quest, if you will, brought you to Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk in your book about the fact, you point out that Kansas City wasn't always segregated.
Well, what happened was, before the Civil War, there weren't that many free blacks in Kansas City. And then with the economic opportunity that came with the Industrial Revolution and the oppression that enveloped the South with Jim Crow, many blacks did start coming west and stayed in Kansas City. And there was lots of economic opportunity for them there. And in 1900, there wasn't a single black neighborhood that was, you know, majority black. There was nothing you would call the black side of town. There was no east of Troost, west of Troost. People segregated by class, as, you know, will typically happen. And it wasn't until the black presence started getting larger towards the end of the 19-teens that they could be scapegoated the way they were in the South.
You make the point, and I think it's a good point, that there's been very little coverage about the real inside story of real estate and mortgage lending and how that really served to keep the country segregated. And one of the people that you talk about in your book, a Kansas Cityan named Bob Wood, was a major culprit in the Kansas City area in terms of segregating communities. Can you talk some about that?
The civil rights movement, you know, with Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks and the Jim Crow laws that were on the books, those can't be ignored. They have to be reckoned with and acknowledged because it's such a visible part of history. But, you know, real estate sort of buried in the ground. It's been very easy for us to avoid that story and not really reckon with it. And the reality of real estate is what it did in the South. Jim Crow was, you know, a legal apartheid. Blacks and whites in the South lived in relative proximity. There weren't really many big major urban areas in the South, and you had all these small towns, and you know, the white side of town was 2 or 3 minutes from the black part of town. But people kept their distance from each other because law and social custom demanded it. Well, in the North, you didn't have Jim Crow as a legal barrier to keep people separated. So what real estate developer J.C. Nichols did was he and other real estate developers sort of, you know, created this idea of white residential space that could be sold as a premium. And
that so important at that time?
Because it gave segregation a profit motive. It privatized it and turned it into a product that you could buy. And so in the South, losing the right to sit at a lunch counter that was all white had a lot to do with losing social status, and white people didn't want to lose the social status of having, you know, exclusive white spaces and department stores and, you know, and so forth. But to lose the value of your property, because we built up this mythology that all white property was more valuable and that a black person moving into the neighborhood took cash out of your pocket, which was a myth because it was real estate agents like Bob Wood who were destabilizing neighborhoods and destroying property values. But anyway, the point being is that once white people internalized the idea that black neighbors would cost you money, not just a loss in social status, well, then that wall was even higher and more impossible to tear down. Martin Luther King, for all his success in the South, when he went north into Detroit and Chicago and tried to march in white neighborhoods, he just had to turn back. I mean, he was pelted with rocks and you know, he's He, as he said famously, people from the South ought to come to Chicago to learn how to hate. And it was when he touched the third rail of the real estate issue, and white people started to think that integration would cost them actual cash money. That was the wall we never got over.
Now, you indicate in your book that, in a way, Kansas City is the birthplace of what you call the segregated American cityscape. If that's true, would you call J.C. Nichols kind of the father of the restrictive covenants that kept neighborhoods white?
Yeah, I call him the Steve Jobs of racism. Because he didn't invent racial covenants. They had existed. Nobody really knows who was the first person to use them or to say you can't sell this house to a black person. Steve Jobs didn't really invent many things either. He appropriated and tinkered with other ideas that existed in the world and, you know, turned them into the Apple or turned them into the iPod. And what J.C. Nichols did was he took this idea of restrictive covenants and he really innovated them. He applied them not just to the house for sale but to the whole subdivision. And then he took the homeowners association and that everyone who lived in that neighborhood was a member of and made that homeowners association legally liable for protecting the whole neighborhood. So therefore, no one member could break the covenant without, you know, violating the contract of living in that neighborhood. And then he also, quite ingeniously, made your voting share in the neighborhood association based on the front footage of your lot, which means that if you had a handful of large property owners could outvote the larger number of owners of smaller lots. And so it was all these innovations that he created that really made the racial covenant ironclad, sought-after product.
There's something in your book that I certainly wasn't aware of, and maybe other people aren't either, that after creating, you know, the Country Club District and Mission Hills here in Kansas City, that J.C. Nichols went on to develop a national real estate organization that then influence similar segregated neighborhoods across the country.
That's one of the things that led me to Kansas City. I grew up in Vestavia Hills, which is sort of like the new money suburb of Birmingham, and then next to it was Mountain Brook, which was very much the Mission Hills of Birmingham. And turns out it was exactly the Mission Hills of Birmingham because the real estate developer from Birmingham was best friends with J.C. Nichols, and they were members of this group together. And when he was founding Mountain Brook in Birmingham, he wrote to his, you know, to J.C. Nichols and said, "Hey, can I use your racial covenants?" And J.C. Nichols said, "More than happy to." And he shared them and sent them on down. And Mountain Brook in Birmingham is a carbon copy of Mission Hills. I mean, there's a you know, Country Club Plaza shopping center just the same as the one in Kansas City, except there's an English Tudor vision village instead of an Andalusian Spanish village. And the same thing happened all over the country. Forest Hills in Queens, New York, Highland Park in Dallas, you know, all these real estate developers. There was basically J.C. Nichols in every major city, and they were all friends, and they all were involved in creating the National Association of Real Estate Boards and creating National Real Estate Board policy. And they were the ones who basically made it part of a realtor's code of ethics nationwide that, you know, introducing unfamiliar ethnic group to an all-white neighborhood is, you know, destabilizing. And it started with J.C. Nichols in Kansas City.
So enter Bob Wood that we've made reference to. Talk a little bit about what he's best known for and some of the tactics that helped the white communities become a place where more and more whites fled.
Well, yeah, as I say in the book, you know, J.C. Nichols built the supply and men like Bob Wood drove the demand. Wood was a blockbuster, as the process became known, which is that you would go to, you know, a block of white houses, and these are over on the east side of Troost where they weren't protected by the same racial covenants as J.C. Nichols' areas on the west side of Troost. And, you know, they would take a block and pick the weakest homeowner, like the elderly widow who was on a fixed income, and they would just start harassing her and saying, you know, "The coloreds are moving in, the blacks are moving in, don't you think you should sell? I'll give you $5,000 for your house today, but if you wait, you'll only get two." And, you know, she'd be terrified. Or what they'd do, if they were particularly creative, a blockbuster would go in and buy a house themselves and then rent it to a black family. But they wouldn't rent it to a working class or middle class black family that, you know, would be the typical type of person to live on that block. They'd go and find recent released prison inmates, black people who fit the worst stereotypes that white people had, and then they would move them onto the block and then start calling all the white neighbors and saying, "See, this is the element that's moving into the neighborhood. Don't you think you should get out?" And it was all a scam. But the only reason it worked was because the federal government and the National Association of Real Estate Boards had created these all-white havens out in the suburbs, because you can only have white flight if you have some place to flee. So the government was building all this new housing stock out in the suburbs, and it was just 1, 2, 3. Real estate developers were creating a selling panic. So the first black family to move in might buy their house for, you know, $15,000 because they were, you know, that desperate to get out of the, you know, the tenements in 18th and Vine. Even though the house was only worth 10, they'd pay 15 for it. Well, then a month later, after having sold off the whole block, the average house value would have been driven down to 2,500. So not only did white families lose most of the value in their homes, but then black families would be left with these underwater mortgages that they'd overpaid for, and they'd default on the house, and then they would just rerun the scam all over again.
And as I understand it, because some of these blockbusters, Bob Wood in particular, they would finance houses themselves. They were having then all kinds of ways to exploit people and reap the benefit.
Right, because what happened was, you know, for years you had this federal program called redlining, which goes back to the Depression, which is that the federal government basically adopted the same policies as the National Association of Real Estate Board and said that the federal government wouldn't underwrite any mortgage in a mixed neighborhood or in a black neighborhood, and that, you know, all these veterans coming home on the GI Bill, their mortgage payments would be no good in a mixed neighborhood or a black neighborhood. And so all those people ended up going out to the city. And so blacks were denied mortgage credit, you know, because it was only available to whites. And so when they tried to fix this in a rather misguided way, they said, okay, well, it's illegal to deny blacks credit. So the remedy to that is that we're going to make you give any black family credit. Well, the only thing worse than, you know, denying someone credit is giving them too much garbage credit that they can't afford to maintain, which is the exact same thing we saw recently in the subprime mortgage crisis. And so all of a sudden, the federal government had guaranteed that if these scam artists gave black people predatory mortgages and they defaulted on them, then they'd be insured by the federal government. So then it was you could bring any black family in with no down payment, give them an inflated mortgage, and then when they default on it, the federal government would give you a check for, you know, 98% of the value of the mortgage. So these blockbusters like Bob Wood would start buying houses and they just move black families through them, destroying their credit and leaving them with no place to be.
Well, and you know, of course, you talk about the truce line that everybody's familiar with, where east of truce is black and west of truce is white, and where you can't get pizza delivery east of truce, your insurance rates are higher, your real estate values are lower, and your life expectancy is lower east of truce. You argue, though, that all of that was created by some of these discriminatory policies that affected housing stock and caused blight.
Mm-hmm. It was more so that, you know, up until, you know, the Brown v. Board decision, the line wasn't as definitive. But before Brown v. Board, the 18th and Vine black neighborhood was kept in place largely by social custom and fear. There had been bombings for any black families that had tried to move out. But two things changed. One was Brown v. Board, which said that you couldn't have racially segregated schools anymore, and the other was just, you know, the rising civil rights consciousness of the, you know, the post-war black community, such that black families were more assertive and more willing to, you know, get out of the tenements, the overcrowded tenements of 18th and Vine, and move out into neighborhoods and face down the threats of white, you know, resistors. And once Brown v. Board outlawed segregated school attendance, then the Kansas City school system shifted from having racially defined school attendance to having neighborhoods defined on or having schools defined by neighborhood attendance. So then you had a system where you had to keep neighborhoods white. Before, you could have one black family move into a mostly white neighborhood and they could still be prevented from attending that school. They'd have to be bused back up to, you know, Lincoln High School or whatever. But after Brown v. Board, you couldn't have a policy like that anymore. So now they had to start shifting real estate barriers so that if a black family moved onto a block, well, then that whole block had to be de-zoned from the white school and rezoned back north towards whatever schools, you know, black majority black schools were in the 18th and Vine area. And what sort of the city fathers said was, okay, well, we can't avoid this anymore because the Supreme Court's decided it. So we'll just let, you know, if blacks want to move out of 18th and Vine, we'll let the east side go black. Because that's where the working class white people are and where we need to really protect the middle class white people over on the west side. And so they just sort of drew a line down truce and said and sort of let people like Bob Wood know, you know, if you go out and do this blockbusting in the working class east side neighborhoods, we're not going to really bother you or come after you. But, if, you know, just stay away from the west side. And that's how the truce wall became what it is today.
This is Casey Currents. We're speaking with Tanner Colby, author of Some of My Best Friends Are Black. Tanner will be speaking at the Kansas City Public Library this Wednesday, October 10th, Go to our website at kcor.org for more information. Now, the one exception that you talk about, or one of the exceptions, is the 4963 neighborhood and its association. And, of course, people locally talk about that as one of the major integration, if you will, successes in Kansas City. Not so fast, you say, though.
Let's put it this way. It's one of the most successful integration experiments in the country, and by which I mean it's marginally successful. It's done many wonderful things, and it's built a foundation that it can continue to grow and become better. But it's by no means a racial utopia. For some people who live there, it is, and some people it isn't. What happened was, you know, when a black family moved into a neighborhood, it became a racially mixed neighborhood, and therefore, you know, it wasn't just blacks getting denied mortgage credit. You could be a white person, and if you wanted to move east of Troost, you'd get your mortgage denied. You know, middle-class white person with good credit, and you can't get a home loan, or your homeowner's insurance triples for no reason just because black families are moving in. And so that really sort of got white homeowners realizing, okay, this affects us too. We've all got, a stake in this. Let's band together to create an integrated neighborhood. And many communities had tried to do that on the east side going back in the 1950s, but none of them really had the toolkit to do it because they were just working class neighborhoods. But when they got to 4963, you had the university there, so you had a lot of university professors with law degrees and economics degrees, and you had the universities themselves, Rockhurst and UMKC, which had a sort of a vested interest in allowing blacks to come in and becoming integrated, but also keeping the stability of the area. So the 4963 group came together and drew a zone from 49 to 63 and from Oak to Paseo and said, let's try an experiment in integration. And from a property rights perspective, from a legal perspective, they did everything right. I mean, it was really just a textbook example of how to create a racially integrated, financially stable neighborhood. They got rid of people like Bob Wood and Blockbusters, and they banned yard signs, and they banned these late night solicitations of scaring people, and they really went after any predatory realtors who were breaking the law, and they created incentives for, you know, honest realtors. You know, they created their own home listing service so that realtors who would only conduct legitimate business would be first in line for legitimate home transactions. And they also formed their own mortgage lender called Neighborhood Housing Services, because if the banks were going to deny mortgage credit to blacks or if the banks were going to deny homeowners insurance to even to whites, they would create their own lending institution and let people work off their mortgage with sweat equity and really create, you know, a neighborhood. You know, the whole neighborhood's roughly 70% white, 30% black today. And they saved the houses, because before we had all these houses being flipped over and turned over and going into foreclosure, then the houses are falling into disrepair. And as you see on the east side of Troost now, whole swaths of neighborhoods are just rotted away and you have to tear them down. So they saved the houses and protected the houses, and they protected the legal and financial foundation of the neighborhood.
But one limitation, though, was, and that you point out, even though on the surface it's an integrated neighborhood, it's celebrated as such, the ability to form real friendships across the races continued to be limited.
Yes.
Why do you think this was?
You know, you had a number of well-meaning white people who wanted to have an integrated neighborhood, but even as in their good intentions, they couldn't really identify with, you know, the working-class black families that were moving in. You had, you know, college-educated university professors and mostly working-class, black people coming in who were working two and three jobs, and had their own social world that oriented back east to the churches and social clubs of the east side. People, you know, tried to get along. You know, they didn't really have the social toolkit to do it. And you see, you also had still a lot of working-class whites who were, you know, of your Archie Bunker type character, who they weren't going to run out to the suburbs, and they, you know, they agreed to live among blacks, but they weren't too thrilled about it. And so, you know, I talked to Alvin Brooks, who was involved in city politics at the time, and he said he'd get a lot of complaints from the neighborhood where, you know, if the black family's kids left their toys out on the white neighbor's lawn, the white people wouldn't just go over to the fence and say, hey, can we talk about your kids leaving their toys on our lawn, you know, like neighbors do. You know, they'd call City Hall and, you know, file a complaint because they weren't interested in having a relationship. You know, if you're neighbors with someone and their kids leaving their toys on your lawn,
you talk to them.
Yeah, you talk to them. But he said, I'd get calls from City Hall for, like, you know, picayune stuff that neighbors should just be solving themselves. And, you know, for the Black community's part, they wanted access to a better life for their kids. They wanted access to the better schools and the better neighborhoods. But they didn't really know if they could trust white people. You know, they had a very well-founded suspicion of, are these white people here to actually be friends with us, or is this another blockbusting scam? You know, I did a chapter about church in my hometown of Lafayette, Louisiana, where I lived before I moved to Birmingham. And the priest who oversaw the integration of a church there put it very well. He said that white people's opposition to integration was based on, you know, imaginary stereotypes, Black people being criminals, you know, Blacks being, you know, lowering property values. And so once they actually encountered honest, decent, good, hardworking Black neighbors, a lot of those stereotypes went away. Not all of them, but, you know, the more outrageous imaginary ones were like, oh, well, that was ridiculous. Why did we ever believe that? And so white people just sort of like, okay, well, you know, if I have some Black neighbors, again, it's the population critical mass problem. Handful of Black neighbors is no big deal. White people eventually got over that pretty quickly. But Black opposition to integration is based on very concrete, well-founded reasons, such as, you know, being assaulted for moving into a white neighborhood, or having bricks thrown through your front window, or the daily slights of your neighbors not wanting to interact with you or talk to you. And so as Blacks moved into places like 4963, they had very good cause to sort of keep people at arm's length and be suspicious of them. But as I said in the book, that was mostly the parents. The kids who grew up in 4963 in the 1970s never knew any different. And that's one of the real lessons I took away from the book, is that integration is not something you do for yourself. It's something you do for your kids, because, you know, two 40-year-old people who've grown up in different worlds and different cultures, we're not necessarily going to become, you know, best friends overnight. We're just coming from two different places. But we can agree to, you know, respect each other and coexist with each other so that our children will grow up right next door to each other not knowing any different.
Tanner Colby will discuss his book, Some of My Best Friends Are Black, on Wednesday, October 10th at the Kansas City Public Library. In addition to his current book, Tanner Colby has authored biographies of comedians John Belushi and Chris Farley.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
Coming up, the aftermath of this summer's drought. This is Casey Currents.